So I guess we should get back to our topic of why learn Gemara for a few minutes. That's a good one. We'll finish that up. When we spoke about it last time, so we mentioned there are differently a few layers to the question, and as is always the case, whenever someone asks you any question, ever, you always have to wonder, do they really want the answer to the question that they're asking? A lot of times, people are bothered by something and they may have a question that's not really what's bothering them, that just might be the way that they're presenting themselves. You know, it happens all the time that a person's frustrated by something or other, and then they'll ask you, well, you know, why do you need to do that anyway? And then you don't really care what the answer is right now. They're really just frustrated by something else. So a lot of times that's true. You know, a person that's enjoying learning Gemara probably isn't going to ask the question about why I learn Gemara. Some people that are a little bit turned off for one reason or another, or frustrated or tired or in the middle of midterms maybe, in Yana de Yuma. But in any case, it's definitely a question that is a good question when a person's really asking it. And there are two different approaches which are based on, the first one's kind of based on what I believe is a fallacy. I think that most people assume that the purpose of learning Gemara is basically to come to conclusions, because what we're trying to do is figure out what to do. So when you're trying to figure out what to do, you have to go back to the sources and you have to know what does the Torah say and how does it apply. So you have to kind of go back to the original sources and break it down and take it through to the end. But the problem with that is that, well, what if I'm not a posek? What if I'm not going to be doing that? And what do we need the whole discussion for? Why can't we just look at Shulchan Aruch? So why doesn't all yeshivas just learn Shulchan Aruch? Learn Halacha L'maisa? After all, that's the bottom line. And let's be honest, none of us are going to be going back to the sources and coming to any different conclusions. So what's the point of really learning Gemara? So I think the answer to that is that that's a mistake. And we'll discuss that Mir Tashem in a couple minutes. That the purpose of learning Gemara, there is part of it, is the sources and being able to come to conclusions, but that's not really the essence of it. Well, the last thing that we mentioned was developing a healthy Torah personality. So just to mention it one more time before we go on, I've had the experience that when you learn with people that don't really appreciate Gemara and the nuances of the Gemara and how precise the Gemara is and how dedicated Chazal were to the precision of the Masorah. So, you know, you come to a certain, you know, even if you're learning Halacha L'maaseh, you're learning Mishnah Berurah, you're learning whatever, and a person says, oh, come on, you know, and brushes it off like that. L'mashal, Pesach is coming. Kitnios. It's a big issue Bizman has that. Everybody's mad about kitnios. Kitnios is pretty clearly a minhag, not more than that. Not even a din de rabbana. It's a minhag. And people are all upset. Well, we can separate it Bizman has that. Well, why should we not have kitnios? So there are two problems. One issue is because these are the types of things that you could make into grains, into things that look like bread. So since rice, you can have all kinds of rice bread and all kinds of things. So, you know, people will get confused, they'll think that bread is okay, or maybe they'll make a mistake and think it's rice bread and it's really regular bread, things like that. And everybody points out that everyone in Bizman HaZeh, no matter what you keep in terms of your matzah meal and your gebrachs, you go to the stores and now you get pancakes and waffles and, right, and all potato starch. So, what's going on, you know? Pizza! You could buy pizza crust that's kosher for Pesach, and there ain't no matzah meal in it. So wait, we should ask for all those things because it looks like bread. Maybe. So the other issue that went into kitnios historically was that whenever there were locations and packing plants or whatever they used to have that were packaging rice and those types of corn, there were always, very often, other grains that got mixed in because they were all being packed in the same places, and so it was tricky. Were you going to go through every single grain of rice and make sure there's no... So yeah, the Sfardim have hashkaches and they go through it, and some of the Sfardim still do it no matter what it is. They go through one by one themselves at home before Pesach to make sure there's nothing else that got mixed in over there. So Ashkenazim, I guess, are lazy. I don't know. Say, no, we don't do that. We just say it's all usher. We don't get involved. And that way we don't run into any problems. So those are the two reasons for kitnios. So people say, oh, come on. Nowadays, there's pizza crust in the stores, it's all potato starch. So what are you talking? We're going to ask for all those things, and then there's nothing left on Pesach. So the and they say, and what do you mean? It's part of Hashgachas, all kinds of things. You know, why should it be Aser? So nowadays, you know, it's a different world. We should change our minhag, etc., etc. The problem is, it doesn't work like that. Why doesn't it work like that? So, for example, the Gemara discusses in various different scenarios that people came to the Gedolim, Rabbi Yochanan, and others, and they said, "Well, you know, our ancestors. So, Lamashal, there was one place where there was a town that was, you know, several kilometers away, and so the town had a minhag because they were, I guess, relatively wealthy." That Erev Shabbos, they didn't go to that town at all because it was too close to Shabbos. And as a type of chumrah in respect for Shabbos, they didn't go to the marketplace in that town at all. So their children, the next generation, so they apparently needed money. So they wanted to know, do we have to keep observing this minhag that we don't go to that town on Erev Shabbos as a chumrah for Kavod Shabbos? But, you know, we need the money. Marketplace. So it was passing for them, you have to stick to your minhagim. Minhagavo seinu bi adeinu. Pasuk from Mishlei. Atitosh Torah simecha. Shema b'ni musar avicha. Atitosh Torah simecha. There's something called Torah simecha. There's traditions that we have, minhagim that we have. And that's a halacha, and that you need to keep observing it. What do you mean? We need the money. So we have to find a different source of money. So figure it out differently. Minhag is minhag is minhag. So exactly how that works and what's the dynamic and the lumbus, all of it is a good shear, it's a fun shear. What exactly, why exactly is Menhagim, are Menhagim binding? But it's clear from the Gemara that there is a binding nature to Menhagim. Maybe it depends on what the minig is, who adapted it, just because a father decides. A great example. Erev Shabbos. This time of year, this past Shabbos, what time did you guys have a Menhagim, remember?
This past Shabbos.
Yeah. 6:45, 6:50, something like that, right? By me, I think it was 6:50. So what's going to happen by me is when it hits 7 o'clock, stick it. It gets stuck there. The Shabbos starts so late, and the children, and like, you know, it's craziness. By the time we sit down, we're finished with our meal, it's way past their bedtime, and they're all killing each other at the table, so it's not going to work. So, you know, some people, their children just like fall asleep or they put them to bed early, but unfortunately or fortunately, my children, like their parents, don't like to sleep, so they all just stay up late and end up killing each other. We don't like human sacrifices at the table. So, we let them stay up. Anyway, point is, 7 o'clock hits, and that's it. We all start Shabbos. What happens if there is a father? He goes to shul, 7 o'clock. Shabbos doesn't start till almost 8 o'clock. But he starts early, like my shul. So the wife, she's at home. Does she have to light candles at the same time that he goes to shul and starts Shabbos? Great question, right? It happens all the time. What if she's working, she comes home late? Like, what's the story with the children? They also have to start Shabbos. What if they haven't showered yet? Which, because they were playing and riding bikes, you know. So what's the story? So the psak halacha is, Rav Moshe Paskin like this, that just because the father is keeping Shabbos that way, it's not something that's binding on the rest of his family because it's a personal chumrah. What do you mean it's a personal chumrah? It's really not even a personal chumrah.
Yeah, but usually doesn't everything that the house of the father go on?
Not really. Just because the father has a certain meaning doesn't mean anything. And Ramosha gives this example. And he says the wife doesn't have to light candles when he's...
The originally, where all of this comes from, it used to be one shul for the town. And now we have what's called a minig hamakom. This is the minig of the place. The minig of the place is that we start Shabbos at 7 o'clock. Oh, well, that's the minig of the town. Then she has to light candles when they come to Shabbos, whatever, whenever they start Shabbos in shul. Because that's the town is starting Shabbos. You're part of the town, right? Yeah. But in Muncie, you know where this is going? 7 o'clock, 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30, you know, remaining time. Like, everyone's starting at different times. There's no such thing as a minig hamakom. So if you want to start Shabbos at 7 o'clock, so that's your personal preference. It's not even a chumrah. What do I mean it's not even a chumrah? And you always, let's say Shabbos starts at 8 o'clock, and he's starting at 7 o'clock. The whole year long he starts an hour early Shabbos? When Shabbos is 3:30, he starts at 2:30? Nobody does that. It's a convenience, a certain time of year, that's all. It's not even a chumrah. It's just a convenience. So in which case, there's nothing doing. No one has to keep his convenience because he went to go. So the truth of the matter is, a guy goes to shul and he comes home and his wife hasn't even lit the candles yet. No. That's not a nice thing to do. I don't think it's the way to go because you should keep Shabbos together and you should come home for shul. You should start your seudah. Like, that's how it should go. But technically, from a halachic perspective, it's not binding. But when you're talking about a minig ha-makom, it's okay. So a minig ha-makom is a minig ha-makom. What about minig ashkenazim? Wow, I mean, that's minig ashkenaz. All the ashkenazim keep kitniyos fardim don't. Well, all ashkenazim keep kitniyos. What are you, it's going to go out the window because, you know, you don't like it? You want to eat rice? You don't think it makes sense anymore? So minhagim are binding. But people that don't appreciate any of the dynamics of the Gemara or how halacha is decided, so they treat it very lightly. And then it turns out that people end up with a very negative attitude towards halacha and like a very dismissive attitude towards a lot of things. And if it doesn't make sense off the cuff to them rationally, so they kind of just like, I don't agree with that. I've heard that line so many times. You know, you don't agree with that? This is Rishonim. This is Tanoim. What do you mean you don't agree with that? Well, I mean, they're trying to say, like, I don't understand the perspective, and therefore I don't agree with it. Okay, you know? So a person that does learn Gemara and appreciates Gemara and can understand where all this is coming from and the precision of Chazal, you know what I mean by the precision of Chazal? That we're not dealing with people who were flippant about accepting things. That's what I like to give my example of the word poke, right? How many times have I asked this year, what does poke mean? Nafkamina. Poke is the shoresh. So the Gemara has this line a few places, poke tani livra. Someone said something in the base medrash that the other people felt was not precise. And they said, poke, get out, tani livra, teach your stuff outside on the street. We're not interested in you being in the base medrash anymore. it was a seriousness and a sense of responsibility towards Masorah. And you get that when you learn Gemara, but if you don't learn Gemara, you don't really see it. And wow, Rav Soloveitchik used to be so bothered by this. He has a great essay, if you're interested in reading it, in the collection called Reflections of the Rav, on Parshas Korach. So he has an essay called The Common Sense Rebellion Against Torah Authority. The Common Sense Rebellion Against Torah Authority. And that's the theme that he develops over there. It's common sense, you know. Korach comes along, it was an ancient approach. Korach comes along and he says, let's say that you have a beged that's all techeles. It's all techeles, it's dyed techeles. You gotta put a little techeles string on the end to remind you of Hashem. Doesn't make any sense. You got a room full of Sefer Torah, you gotta put a mezuzah on the door. How does that make any sense? So that was his end. So the Rav develops that type of idea. So I do think that even if one would argue that the purpose of learning Gemara is to come to conclusions, still, if a person is not really, doesn't have a good experience of Gemara, he doesn't have a healthy Torah attitude. You relate to what I'm saying at all? No comments. Okay, anyway, that's one point. Of course, many people point out that to make our practices meaningful, so it certainly is helpful and beneficial to know where everything's coming from. We do a lot of things, and we don't always know why we're doing it. People ask questions, and sometimes people don't ask questions, and sometimes people don't know the answers to the questions, and sometimes occasionally feel embarrassed when someone asks a question, like, where are you covering those challahs? I don't want them to be embarrassed. Really? You know?
You don't want to know the answer to the question.
You what?
You don't want to know the answer to the question.
Why would you not want to know the answer? Oh, that's also true. Sometimes people misunderstand the concept and they say, we know there's a principle in halacha that it's better to be doing something b'shogeg than to be violating something b'mezid. B'shogeg means like almost accidentally. But b'mezid means you're doing it on purpose. So I'm going to be doing this wrong, so it's better to be ignorant than actually be doing something wrong. Ignorance is bliss, right? Yeah, so. I don't know, it's not exactly the case. What principle comes up when it comes to telling somebody else that they're doing something wrong, you know? But if a person has a responsibility to learn and know what he's doing wrong, I don't know that it'll apply. But definitely it's safe to say
especially, you know, I assume it was always this way. I don't know that it's any different. There's something called social Judaism. You think it was not like that in history? It's always like that.
I think it's always
existed. I would assume so, you know. This is how you grow up, and you don't always know why you're doing this, but that's what everybody does. It's just like a cultural thing, you know. It's just that the difference, I think, between the, in other words, the nafka mina, the implication and the consequences of social Judaism, let's say 200 years ago and now, is that 200 years ago it didn't mean anything because you were still going to be socially Jewish for the rest of your life, and so were your children. Because what are you going to do? You're going to leave the shtetl and go move in with a bunch of goyim. It wasn't going to happen. Nowadays, the social Judaism results in people saying, why should I do this?
So now there's a
not believe in God and be the capacity to just move into a community and be accepted and just dump it all. You know, like, why should I do this? You know, whereas in the past, it wasn't like that. You weren't going to be accepted. You know, amongst the non-Jews, they were still going to treat you like a Jew whenever you tried to do. Nowadays, what do you mean? So that's where it really makes a big difference, Bisman, is that people don't understand where halacha is coming from and where Jewish practice is coming from. So they just treat it like it's some bizarre tradition and why should I keep it? So what does it help to learn Gemara? In the realm of making it meaningful, so you can help me with this, but I can think of at least two different categories in that sense. One way to make things meaningful is simply knowledge of the development of what it is. Trying to trace things back. Is it from the Torah? Is it not from the Torah? Is it a rabbinic creation? Is it not a rabbinic creation? If it is a rabbinic creation, well, why did they structure it that way? Not a technical thing. The first point I was making was technical. To appreciate the precision and how it works, the dynamics, and so that you can observe your practice and keep kitnios, and it shouldn't bother you that I'm keeping some weird ancient tradition that doesn't make any sense anymore. No, I'm following because it's a minigav useinu, and you know, we can develop that idea in its own way. But that's a technical point. Forget the technicalities of it. Let's talk about it being meaningful to us. Well, why does the Torah say? Are there certain sefer hachinuch, right? It's a great sefer to understand why we observe certain mitzvahs. What are their benefits to us? Why did the rabbis say certain things? Why did they impose it upon us at all and in the way that they did? Does it apply anymore? Do you wash your hands before pickles? Most people do not wash their hands before pickles. They had pickles at the Kiddush on Shabbos. I decided I was going to go wash my hands. Because it's a big discussion. Why do you wash your hands before bread? Kohanim, want to make sure all the Kohanim are washing their hands before they eat their truma. Well, you don't have Kohanim eating truma anymore, but that at least is one that's on the books. That we want all the Klal Yisrael to be washing their hands so the Kohanim get used to washing their hands, so that way when they pick up their bread that's truma, they'll have their hands washed. So wait a minute, so it's all about Tumah V'Tahara? Yeah, well, no Tumah V'Tahara Bizman HaZeh. Nobody's makpid on Tumah V'Tahara because we're not a Beis HaMikdash and it doesn't make a difference. So because of that, the minig of most people in Kalal Yisrael is that so we just don't care anymore. But technically speaking, there's this thing called karpas at the Seder. What do you do before karpas? Wash your hands. Kadesh, urchatz, karpas, urchatz, urchatz, why? Well, the child at the Seder is supposed to think what? Oh, we're washing our hands for matzah. That's what always happens. Kadesh, mekadesh, urchatz, wash your hands. Then you have matzah. Instead, they bring out the, what do you guys have? Parsley? My father has potatoes. Okay, you bring out the parsley, the potatoes, the celery, whatever it is, and you dip it. So why are you washing your hands? So that's just to make the child ask a question, right? Why are we doing this? But the truth is, one of the reasons we do it is because technically that's the halacha. When you're going to have a wet vegetable, now the vegetable is susceptible to tumah. And if your hands are tame, you're going to be metamei the vegetable. So you got to wash your hands before you dip a vegetable into a liquid. That's technically the halacha. It's just that there's a machlokas, a poskim. Do we still observe those things, or did they go out the window since we're not makpid and tumah v'tahara anymore? So there are poskim that say, yeah, what do you mean? That's what you should do bizman hazeh. So if you're going to have a pickle and you're not going to dry it off, it's going to be wet. So you should wash your hands like you would for bread. I'm not telling you to do it. I'm just saying that that's on the books. So one way to make things meaningful is to understand why we do the things we do and what they're about and the significance of it from a halachic perspective as well as from a meaningful perspective, what the reasons may be behind it, even if you're talking about mitzvos. The Rambam in one place says, karbanos are chukim. But yet, the same Rambam, but that's his approach. In Mar Nevuchim, wow, we spoke about this last week. The whole approach to karbanos. Why? The whole approach. What do you mean? I thought it was a chuk. The Rambam says, because you're supposed to try to understand chukim the best you can. So, that's one way to make things meaningful. So, I don't know. What do you say about this? Let's say a person has a job. He's looking for a job. Nobody wants an insignificant job. Everyone wants a job that they make a difference in the company. Eventually, they work their way up. They make more money. They have an impact maybe on the world, at least on the business, you know, something like that. So a person first gets his job. He's very low on the totem pole, as they say. People are always just telling him what to do. And, you know, are people happy with that? The answer is most people are probably not, unless they're making enough money to get by and they don't really care. You know, a lot of people are looking for more. They want to understand things. So, yeah.
You're making a lot of assumptions. Go
ahead.
You know, but, I mean, it's subjective. Significance and significance is subjective based on the person. The individual selling you sneakers in the sneaker store, they're making a difference. Maybe not on the same quantifiable level as someone who's high up in the State Department or something of that nature, but...
But what I mean to say is, I think it's true that, let's use your example, a guy gets a job at, you know, Foot Locker.
The janitor at YU.
Janitor, anybody. So because there are other people around in the business place that are telling them what to do,
right,
they don't like being told what to do.
Maybe.
And they want to move up on the on this chain in some way or another, whatever they feel they're capable of. No, maybe, you don't think it's true?
Maybe they feel they've reached their maximum.
Sometimes people may feel they've reached their capacity. But if they feel their capacity is greater than that, I think they want to move up.
Right. But we can't assume that every individual deems their capacity to be greater than...
No. But whatever a person does feel he's capable of, I think that if they don't like just being told what to do and being when they know about themselves or feel about themselves, that they could reach higher. So is what about when it comes to Torah? What about when it comes to knowledge about things in our observance of Jewish practice? Is it any different? How come people are satisfied just doing things without really knowing where it comes from or being a person that's capable of doing more, knowing more? Is that a fair comparison?
I think so.
There's a lot of creativity in Torah, you know? And while when it comes to Psak Halacha in that way, I guess that's less wiggle room for your average person. But to understand Torah, to be able to have insights into Torah, to be able to say things that are chidushim on one level or another, that's available to everybody.
Perhaps or some may think they lack the capacity to be Hebrew.
But they can learn. They can learn. Or if they can't, there's so much English that's available. Things in every language nowadays, ooh, wah, wah. So much available. So why is it that people, many people, are not reaching for more?
Self-esteem issues. Is that one? There was something Rabbi Saxis about it that discussed self-esteem issues. He was citing another rabbin who mentioned it. I forget what it was.
Okay. Maybe people don't feel they're really capable, just like they would feel at work they're not really capable of more. But they are. There's so much accessible. There's so much. Even if it means a person, that there are a lot of people that aren't necessarily so good at processing information that's, you know, that they read. It's true. But the shiurim available, b'zman hazeh, maybe you could listen to, just an audio. Incredible stuff. And then it's very clear. It's not like you have to listen to somebody speaking in Yiddish. There's so much available. So I think that's an important question to ask. Is that if a person is really saying, I'm not interested in Gemara. But what is Gemara really? Gemara really is a deeper understanding of the mechanisms, the dynamics, how exactly things go from the Torah to us. whether it's rabbinic in the middle because it's a rabbinic invention, or whether it's just interpretation, or it's just direct Mesorah, whatever it is. But why would you want to be a person that's just being told what to do all the time? Don't you want to feel that you have a handle on some of this? Don't you want to, really just be a janitor forever? Like, be a person that's in control of this. Now, in control is a funny thing, because people want to be in control. It just means knowledge. The other day, the power went out in Pomona. There was a fellow who drove his car into one of the poles. And the poles didn't, he didn't actually damage the electricity, but because apparently he was leaning over, supposedly the electric company decided they were going to shut it off as a precautionary measure. Fine. Nobody had power. So what happened? So Shabbos, everybody did whatever they needed to do. Some people left, some people got generators. Fine. Sunday, everybody was trying to get back to regular life. Our chat was hot the whole day. Did you see the trucks? How many trucks? You said, they're coming, they're Dunkin' Donuts. They're not coming in, they're coming, they are coming, what do they do? And the whole day was all about what's the progress on the electricity. What's the point?
You have no control.
You have no control. The answer is, but it feels like I have control when I have knowledge. Knowledge is control, right? When I know what's going on, I feel it. And that's the same thing that happens a lot of times. You know, sometimes... What's the difference? No, but you feel like you can. It's a funny thing, but it's true. The more people know, the more they feel they're on some level in control, even when they're not. I know, but it's a feeling that people want in every area. This is just a great example. There's nothing you're going to do about it. Nothing. When they get the electricity on, it's going to be on. You can hawk about it the whole day long, it's not going to be on faster. But everyone wants to know. And when they do know, they feel better. It's the same thing in the cases that you were talking about. When a person, Rahman al-Itzlan, we should never experience these things. But, you know, a person that's very sick goes to the hospital. On the one hand, for the family to know what's going on and be able to address the medical condition, great. But sometimes it's, come on. You're going to tell the doctor what to do? But everybody wants to know what's going on. But yet people do, incorrectly. What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? And everyone wants to know what's going on. Why do you want to know what's going on? What do you care? What's the difference? Can it change anything? No, it's not going to change anything. But it makes us feel better. Because knowledge makes us feel that we are part of this. And same thing with terror. You know, to just be doing things, yeah, that feels not good. But to be able to have insights into it, even though you're not going to paskin anything, it's a feeling of being part of this world of dirt, and then it connects to you. What do I mean by meaningful in that way? It's meaningful in the sense that you feel this is something to do with you, even when it's not relevant, but you feel like you understand it, and then you feel like you relate to it, and then it means something to you. And that's something that can be very, very powerful. It can really richen a person's halachic life. And then, of course, there's just, you know, personally making things meaningful. That I understand how this relates to me and how it improves me and how it puts me in like a historical context. I can appreciate where I'm coming from in Judaism. But more primarily, what really has a greater impact on people is when they observe certain things that they feel are changing their life in a positive way. When you can find those things, you know, how is this making me a better person one way or another? But all of that is still in the realm of, but at the end of the day, Gemara is about coming to the bottom line. Let's change gears. The truth of the matter is that if that's all it was, then okay, so learn a little bit of Gemara, gain an appreciation of the dynamics a little bit, understand how it could be meaningful a little bit, but you don't have to learn everything in Shas. There would be no reason to spend so much time learning Gemara. So why is it that everybody is so focused, the whole world, still so focused on Gemara, 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 Gemara? So the answer to that really is because Gemara is not about coming to conclusions. It's not only about coming to conclusions. It's about the Gemara's process. So what is it? What is this Gemara's process? What are we supposed to gain from it? So number one, a Gemara teaches us how to think. The Common Core is something everybody talks about, Bisman is in New York, because they're trying to institute new ways to educate. And they feel, correctly, that students listen to what the teacher has... Well, okay, they don't listen to what the teacher has to say, but when a test... when they know they have to study for the test, so then they have to know what the teacher wants to hear. And that's a terrible way of educating.
You just want to know what the teacher wants to hear. You're not really learning. You're just spitting back information so that you'll get a good grade. So the Common Core's idea, part of it, was supposed to be that people are learning. They're learning how to think about things. And that's really what Gemara is all about. When we speak about Gemara, what do we mean? There's something called Tarush HaBichsav, Chumash. There's something called Tarush HaBalpeh. Really, that's Mishnayos. Memorize it. Got it. Now, of course, we don't do that anymore. We don't really memorize Mishnayos so much. But Mishnayos are something that were meant to be memorized. And the process of understanding them and connecting it back to the Tarush HaBichsav and applying it to life, all of that is called Talmud. It's called Gemara, which means it existed ever before our Gemara did. When you find Tanoim speaking about Talmud, and you find it, what are they talking about? It didn't exist yet. The Talmud was written by the Amoraim. How could the Tanoim be talking about a concept of Talmud? So what's the answer? Because for them, Talmud meant the understanding, extrapolation, connections, contradictions. Everything that the Gemara does is called Talmud. Our Gemara is just the way that we go about doing it, because it gets us to the conclusions that are halacha lamais, and we do have that type of masorah, have a halacha lamais that we do follow a process, okay? But at the end of the day, learning Gemara is not meant to be memorizing Mishnayos. Learning Gemara is supposed to be a process of understanding the question, the answer, the thought process, why this, why not this, what about, how do you prove something, you prove it from this, oh, but you have a question on that. It teaches you how to think on a very basic level. That's why it was the Koreans, no? That's why they're so excited about these things. They want to know how to think. Why does that Jews do it? They're doing pretty good. How many Nobel Prize winners? The Jews, right? We're very successful at thinking, being creative. So from a totally secular perspective, so the Gemaras are a really great way to learn how to think. And that's why so many Jews end up in law school, you know? That's Gemara. Take a case. Figure it out. What's the precedent? How to apply it? You know, does it work? Does it not work? What are the differences? Why might you compare it to this? Why might you not compare it to that? Which comparison is more valid? And how do you prove that? And that's really what the Gemara is all about. Much more. See, that's one of the problems with Daf Yomi is that you don't necessarily get that. It's just listening to a shir to understand what the daf was. It's like memorization of a Mishnah. That's not what Talmud's supposed to be. Talmud's supposed to be the thought process. And it teaches you how to think about everything in life, right? Because it teaches you how to think. Don't just take things for granted. Question it. Attack it. Well, how do you know that? Is it really true? But I can compare it to this. So that's one thing that's very important. You know, the Ramchal, Moshe Chaim Lutzato, has a whole book called The Book of Logic. It's translated into English. And that's one of the points that he makes, is that it teaches you how to be a logical person on a very basic level.
You're reading the argument.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to take it for granted. Does that question make sense? Does that make sense? Would I have asked that question? One of the things I love to say is sometimes you read a question or you read a statement, you read a Rashi, you know, whatever it is, and, you know, you just go on with your life. And one of the things you always have to ask yourself is, would I have written it like that? And a lot of times when you ask that question, it comes out that no, I would not have written it like that. For example, we were talking about Megillah recently. In Shulchan Aruch, it's from the Gemara, but in Shulchan Aruch it says that you're supposed to read the Megillah once at night and, well, Shulchan Aruch says, and repeat it the next day. None of us would have written it like that. We never would have said repeat it. You would say you have to read it once at night and once during the day. What are you repeating?
Repeating the Megillah.
Why? Just say again. You're saying it again. You're not repeating it. I mean, you're right. It is repeating it. But none of us would have written it like that. Because we would have said you have to do it twice. Why is it considered a repetition?
Because you read it once already.
Right. Is that all there is to it? Or there's more to it than that? So I argue there's more to it than that. There's a message in that. But whether you agree or disagree, it's a point that you have to stop yourself and say, why does it say it like that? Is there a significant? Or maybe there's not. So that, and the Gemara is always like that. Why does the Gemara have to say it like that? Why
you're using the same trope and whatnot, night and day. You're using the same tune, the trope, night and day. So you're essentially repeating.
So how come we wouldn't have said it like that originally? Why would we just have said you have to read it twice? Why would we not have focused on the repetition aspect of it?
Because twice doesn't necessarily equate to two equal readings. It's just an arbitrary number.
Perhaps.
And also twice doesn't have a specified time.
Okay. So, you know, whatever it is that you're going to say, but I think it is adding something. It's adding something that wouldn't have had you just said read it twice.
Read it twice is too unspecified.
Fine. I'm okay with that. I'm just saying, like, whatever the reason is, it's just a point that we wouldn't... I don't think any of us would have started to think about it until you stop yourself and you say, you know, I don't think I would have written it like that. And then, you know, it opens up certain doors. So, you know, on the one hand, then, according to this approach, so you'll say, well, you know, is the Gemara the best way to learn rational thinking or not the best way to... Maybe there are other ways to learn... If that's the only value to it, who says it has to be specifically through Gemara? Maybe we should just learn logic and, you know, and just learn how to think, you know, in some other way. So one interesting thing to point out is that we learned that Gemara recently. Do you remember this, Josh? We said... This was in Sukkah, and then Beis Amad Aleph. So the Gemara gets involved with all kinds of issues of Kitanim and Chinuch. And when it speaks about chinuch, one of the things it mentions is that yodea ledaber, when a kid knows to speak, aviv lomdo Torah, his father teaches him Torah. Well, what do you mean? He doesn't know how to think. He just knows how to speak. Abba. So you're supposed to teach him Torah. So it's Torah tziva lanu moshe. Why? So the answer is so that his speech develops with Torah. It's like Makadish him at a young age. Instead of him beginning to speak with, you know, who knows what, he'll actually begin. You know, there's a story of Yeshua's mother. She used to bring his baby carriage into the Beis Medrash so that when his ears began to develop their hearing, which was probably already in Europe, but when his ears develop, you know, hearing, and they hear words for the first time, really, so then it's developing with words of Torah. And it's an interesting thing. So too, you know, when we learn our logic, that's certainly the best way to do it. From a Jewish perspective, is that we should learn how to think with all kinds of Torah thoughts. Of course, as you go a step further, it's not just about the logic. It's about the topics. It's about how to think in a certain way, because it's not just about logic, it's about how to think about Torah. It's about how to think about halacha. And there are certain perspectives that come across when you learn Gemara that don't come across when you're learning anything in the secular world. Titles, you know? You don't always call people so. You need to use a person's first name, use his last name, you know, so and so. Johnston, you know, Johnston said, you know, this, that, and the other thing, you know. But Rebbe this, Rebbe that, or the title, there's a sense of one of the most beautiful words. Ruchaim Elojner, he comments on the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos that have a misabek, but afar regalayim. And Pirkei Avos were told you're supposed to be misabek at the dust of their feet. What does that mean? You're supposed to have the sages around you. You're supposed to be sitting. I don't know, sitting? I don't know if they sit. At the dust of their feet. Like, what does it mean? Misabek usually means to cling. Okay. Be'afar, in the dust. Raglayim of their feet. So it means cling to the dust of their feet? Like, what does it mean? So it means different things. Ruchaim Elojner has an idea. That he says, Misabe comes from the word when Yaakov is wrestling with the Malach, the Sarah Shal Esav, he says, Vayeyavek Ishimo, that a man struggled with him. Why is it related to the word Avak? Avak means dust. So he says, because when people are wrestling and they're trying to get footing, so if there's dirt on the floor or they're outside, so it raises dust. So that's how the word wrestling came to derive itself from dust. Because when people are wrestling, so they raise the dust from the floor. That's what he claims. So that's how he explains Yaakov when he's wrestling with Esav, Vayeyavek Ishimo, that they're raising the dust because we're wrestling with each other. So he says, according to that, it really means to wrestle. Ve'ev misabek, you should make yourself wrestle, ve'afar reglayim, at the dust of their feet. He says, what does that mean? He says, because you have to approach Gemara and anything in Torah in this way. You have to wrestle. Don't accept what it says. You gotta fight. That's what it says. Does that make sense to you? Does the answer make sense? But in all of that fighting, there's a perspective. The perspective is that we're ba'afar reglayim. You have to know who you're arguing with. It doesn't mean you don't argue. It means that at the end of the day, in the background, you know that what you're fighting, who you're fighting with, is a person that has a Masorah and is telling you something. But you have to make it work. It has to make sense. It has to be clear. But at the end of the day, you have to know who you are and who you're talking to. And that's a constant perspective that the Gemara is always bringing out. Because, you know, okay, well, Tana, he's a Tana. So, you know, you accept the Tana says, you're an Amora. So you get the perspective of how things are working and who's who on this, you know, on the hierarchy. So all kinds of things that come out for Gemara that helps develop this Torah, this healthy Torah perspective. When you're learning Gemara specifically, to be able to develop how to think, and you're developing how to think about the Torah, and then you develop the proper approach to Torah itself. And of course, it expands way beyond halacha. It allows us to understand all kinds of things in life and evaluate things in life. And then when it comes to asking shailas and be able to understand things, so we have a whole perspective. So I think that's really important. And I think that we all encounter people in life that, you know, think rather emotionally. And, you know, listen, people are emotional people. It's the way we are. But certainly when you start to learn how to think, how to debate, how to ask a question, how to ask a question respectfully, and how to... It has the potential to really change a person and how he debates and how he, you know... The process of learning Gemara helps with that too. Of course, perhaps the ultimate answer to the question of why learn Gemara may go back to something that's much more mystical than anything else. That the process of learning Gemara is Torah, there's no question about it. Even though you'll have perspectives that are rejected sometimes in the Gemara. So how could that be Torah? You're learning something that's rejected. So that goes back to what we said a minute ago, because the Talmud is the process. And in the process of being wrong is also part of the process. And when something is proven inaccurate and you know why, well, that's also critical in terms of learning how to learn and approaching it. So that's also part of the process of Talmud, and it's considered Torah, and you can make up Birchas Torah on that too. Even Beis Shammai, you don't paskin like, but it's still the process of learning Torah. So when a person learns Torah, there are different ways that you can engage and connect yourself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So in a more mystical way, we know that a person is composed of different elements of his neshama, of his soul. This was called nefesh, this was called ruach, there's neshama, and there are higher levels as well. Which on some level means that there's a sense of being alive, there's physical sensations that we have, and then there's more spiritual sensations that we have. Whether that's emotions, or whether that's things that we can't really pinpoint because it's almost like I'm feeling spiritual. You gotta be careful about feeling spiritual. I hear about this girl that clawed out her eyes. No? I forgot where she lived exactly, but she was on meth. Yeah, that sounds right. She was on meth, right? And she was hallucinating, and she mamish clawed out her eyes.
I don't know if that's spiritual.
No, so I read an article about it. She claimed that all of these things helped her feel what she referred to as spiritual. That when she got involved with all of these different drugs, she always felt very spiritual when she was on them. And by the way, she did this for a religious reason. It was religious hallucinations. She was actually in front of a church. So you got to be careful when we speak about what it means. It's terrifying, no? When we speak about spirituality, see, you have to be careful. But be that as it may. Yeah, 100%. But there is something called spirituality, and when a person's involved in a mitzvah, he may feel something, or he may just feel his emotions. Yeah, so how do you know what's really just what's real and what's not? So I like to say, Rav Kahn likes to tell over the story I've told you many times about this woman in Boston who wanted to wear a talus. So she came to her shul rabbi and said, I want to wear a talus. She said, well, one of the advantages of having one of the Gedolei HaDor in our town is that I can send this question to him. Go ask Rabbi Soloveitchik. So she did. And he told her, here's what I think you should do. I want you to wear a talus without any tzitzis for whatever time, a month, whatever it was, he told her. And then come back and we'll talk. She said, great. So she put on the shawl. And then she came back. So he says, tell me about your experience. So she described a spiritual experience in her mind. you know, in whatever language she used about her soul playing with, dancing with the angels, and whatever she said. And Sir Salabesh looked at her and said, obviously you didn't have a spiritual experience because you weren't doing a mitzvah. You did nothing. You were wearing a shawl. So if you think that having a shawl on is a spiritual experience, you don't know what a spiritual experience is. And that was the point that he was trying to make, is that we have emotions, we have all kinds of things that could be misinterpreted as spirituality. To the extent that you're doing something that actually connects your neshama to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you can argue you had a religious, a spiritual experience. But if you're not doing anything that's connecting your neshama to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then what you're experiencing cannot be a spiritual experience. So when we learn Torah, we have an opportunity to connect ourselves in ways that nothing else can. Aside from the fact that learning Torah is considered to be doing all the mitzvahs at once, that we know that Elu Dvarim She'ein Lahem Shiur, that when the Mishnah tells us there are certain things in Peah that has no amount, it says Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, and Talmud Torah corresponds to all of them. That somehow by learning Torah we're actually, as if we're accomplishing all the mitzvahs in one. It's the most powerful mitzvah that there is. But as you describe it more in a more mystical way, so it means that you're saying words with your mouth. Hopefully you're saying the words with your mouth, right? And not just thinking the Torah, you're supposed to say the words, right? So you're saying the words, your body is active. You know the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, so he describes there are two types of shuckling, right? That's what they call in Yiddish, right? Shuckling, when you move back and forth, when you're daven and when you learn. And the Ramah says they're different. Because when you move back and forth, when you're davening, it's because you want your entire body to be involved in praising Hashem. Kol atzmosai tomarna Hashem kamoicha. All my bones are involved in saying, who is like you, Hashem? But when we learn, the Ramah says, it's not the same thing. When we learn, we're trembling because we're trying to bring ourselves back to Har Sinai, which is, you know, a beautiful thing to think about. And Har Sinai was very, it's like a terrifying thing. And we learn, we want to feel like we're receiving the Torah from a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that's how seriously we're taking it, and trying to have that perspective. But be that as it may, when a person uses his body, he's involving his nefesh in learning Torah. And when he gets excited about it, so then he's involving his ruach. And when he's really thinking about it, and he's really, his brain, you know, he's sweating because he's thinking so hard, or trying to work these out, he's really, really thinking it through, so then his brain, which corresponds to his neshama, a higher level of the soul, is very involved. The way that it's described, let's say in Nefesh HaChaim and other places, is that there's a glass blower. It's just a mashal. The glass blower is, so to speak, a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to create the glass, a person. So the glass blower takes a deep breath, puts the tube to his mouth, and starts blowing it in. And the air is always connected. It's not separated. He doesn't go and let it go. He's blowing it up like a balloon. I've seen it before. It's really cool. You ever see glass, a glass blower? Like someone make like a glass? It's so cool. It's this molten thing. It's just like a ball of like molten nothingness. And then you take this tube, and then it just becomes, and you roll it, and it becomes this like a glass, like before your eyes. It's like really incredible. But in any case, what gives it its shape is that he's blowing this air into it through the tube. So as the air comes to rest in the tube and gives it a shape, it's vayinofash. Hashem rested, right? He created everything. But you know, fash. When something comes to rest, it's called nefesh. So the breath as it comes to rest is called the nefesh in the glass. And it gives the glass its shape, its identity. But of course, it's being blown at the same time as that's happening. It's not disconnected from the breath. So the tube is the ruach. It's outside of the person. It is his breath, but now it's a wind because it's outside of him. So that's the wind that's going into it. But the breath by him himself is because he took a breath and he's constantly blowing it out from within him. So the neshama, the neshima, the breath itself, is actually in the glass blower. And of course he's thinking what he wants to make from the beginning, so it's in his mind as well. But that whole process is what we're constantly connected to Kadosh Baruch Hu in that way. But we can energize every element of it. We can energize the nefesh by being involved physically in a mitzvah. We can energize our ruach by being emotional about, excited about the mitzvahs that we're doing. We can energize our neshama by really thinking and really getting our essence of our thought process involved in what we're doing. And then we're connecting all of our neshama, all of our nefesh, ruach, and neshama in a very heavy way. We're connecting it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when that chain of events happens,
So then the breath of a Kaddish Baruch Hu goes all the way through, straight to us, and there's the potential to even feel it, but certainly it's a reality. So there is absolutely, so you could do this by every mitzvah. Every mitzvah, well, some mitzvahs are only mitzvahs of thought. Some mitzvahs are technically only mitzvahs of action. But every mitzvah, you could do this. You could have the element of the action and the excitement and the thought process, and you can connect yourself in a heavy way to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, really with every mitzvah. But by Torah, it's like the definition of what it is. Torah is this opportunity. And Chazal say that there were a couple of Talmid Chachamim and they were learning a certain sugya, Pilegesh Begiva, and they're arguing over whatever it caused, this, that, and the other thing. And so they said, what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, doing at that moment, you know? So description is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying the same things as the people learning are saying. What does that mean? So on a certain level, it means that how did HaKadosh Baruch Hu give us Torah, the first time we were ever given any Torah? How did Hashem do it? The answer is he spoke. The same way the world was created, with speech. And the neshama is called neshama because it means vayipach va'apav nishmas chayim, that it's a breath. Neshima means a breath. So HaKadosh, to our neshama is really, so to speak, a breath of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So anytime there's dibur, breath is being expressed. And since we know that Klal Yisrael and the Torah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu are all tied together, so whenever the Torah is being expressed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the neshamas of Klal Yisrael are being expressed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when a person learns down here, and Chazal say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying along the words with us as we say them, it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is breathing those words of Torah out, and they are connecting to us. And if we allow that chain of events that we're saying it, and we're excited, and we're thinking, then it allows all of that to flow straight into us where we are. And it can have a tremendous impact on a person. But let's say a person's just learning, you know, halacha. Not such a thought process. You're not so involved, you know. A person's just, you know, reading something, just thinking something. So, okay, he's involved on some level. I mean, you ever been to a beis medrash where people are arguing over Gemara? You think they're going to kill each other, you know? but that's what brings it through. It's the most powerful form of connection. It's a funny thing to say unless you hear it expressed in some level the way I just did. But learning Torah is the most spiritual experience you could have. Nobody thinks of it that way. Because spiritual means like, you know, I feel a little something, whatever. But in reality, it's the most spiritual experience a person can have because he's connecting himself in the deepest, heaviest, strongest, most powerful way. The Kadosh Baruch Hu, Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam, it corresponds to all of the mitzvahs. So that probably really is the best reason to learn Gemara. Because if you're really into it, you're really connecting in a way that it's got to have an impact. When a person leaves the base medrash, he may not realize it, but he somehow managed to connect himself, you know. So that, you know, that's definitely something to consider as well. So again, just on a summary, some of the ideas that we've discussed, and I definitely want your feedback about all of this, is that most people think that learning Gemara is really tachlis-oriented. It's about just getting to the bottom line. So if you say it like that, then there are certain reasons that are beneficial to learning Gemara. You know, just because you want to have a healthy personality, and you want to be able to understand things, you want to be a little bit in control, you know, and whatever. All those things are true. But really, Gemara is more about the process than it is about the conclusions. Otherwise, at the end of the day, you know, just learn English art school books, the halacha l'maaseh, you know. So the process has all of the benefits that the process has, and the process also has benefits that we're really, it gives us the opportunity to have the most spiritual experience that there really is. So those are some thoughts. Anything you want to say? No? All right. Very good. So that's the story.